Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science. The lead story today, once again, is the coronavirus. And first, the bad news. And of course, it is very bad news. We now know that coronavirus is the leading cause of death in the United States, surpassing heart disease and cancer. Life expectancy. Life expectancy has dropped 1.13 years for the average American as a consequence. Not to mention the fact that people are waiting hours, weeks, months to get vaccinated. The state of New York, where I live, the governor just announced that they have officially run out of vaccine. Zero, nada. People wait hours in line to get vaccinated, only to be told that tens of thousands of appointments are being canceled because there's simply no more vaccines left. And also in Boston, it turns out there was a very unfortunate mishap. A worker apparently unplugged the electricity to a freezer, and all the thousands of vaccines had to be destroyed as a consequence. So the bad news keeps on piling up. So what's the good news in all of this? The good news is, well, hard to believe, but the good news is that new cases of the virus are actually beginning to fall. We've peaked, now we're simply over the hump. The death rate is also falling, and the question is why? Why are we seemingly beginning to go over the hump with regards to the coronavirus? And then, because new variations are springing up in South Africa and also the United Kingdom, the government is recommending new masks. That is, add another layer in the mask that you use to cover your nose and your mouth. So we'll say a few things about N95, KN95, and KF94, three versions of masks which are much more efficient than anything you can make out of cloth. And speaking of the virus, it turns out that dogs are being used not just in Finland, as we reported earlier, but also the United Arab Emirates, Chile, and now Miami at sports events to flag individuals that could be infected with the coronavirus. Believe it or not, in 10 seconds, these dogs can apparently find people that have been infected by the virus with 95% accuracy. So how reliable is that? And one day, will we be able to duplicate that with artificially intelligent machines? And then we'll say a few things about outer space. You know, because we've now cataloged 4,000 planets going around other stars, we're beginning to pick up oddballs. Remember in Star Wars, there was a controversy because there was a scene where Luke Skywalker is looking into the heavens and there is a double star system in the sky. Well, a lot of astronomers giggled and laughed and said, ha, it just goes to show you how little science the producers at Hollywood understand. But it turns out that the astronomers were wrong. Now we found a star system with 6 stars. Let me repeat that again. A star system with 6 stars rotating around each other. And we found that with the test satellite and other means by which we catalog these extrasolar planets. So we now realize that the universe is a lot weirder than we previously thought. And speaking about 2020, it was a bad year, not just for the lockdown, for the lives that were lost by the thousands, but also because 2020 has now tied with 2016 as the hottest year ever recorded in the history of science. Yes, even with carbon dioxide levels dropping because of the coronavirus and the lockdown, even then, 2020 has now tied with 2016 as the hottest year ever recorded in the history of science, and that has repercussions. Think of all the forest fires that engulfed California, for example. It turns out that, of course, there were several contributing factors to that, not just global warming, but global warming was certainly one of the factors driving the intensity of the firestorm of fires that engulf the state of California. Well, now let's jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The lead story today, once again, is the bad news concerning the coronavirus. It is now the leading cause of death in the United States. It's causing life expectancy to drop in the United States, dropping by 1.13 years for the average American. But now we have to worry about the South African mutation. Now, of course, there's been a lot of news about the United Kingdom mutation. It is 50% more infectious and perhaps 30% more deadly than the usual variety. And it's estimated that by March, it will be in the United States, the dominant strain. It is growing so fast, it's pushing out other varieties of the coronavirus. And not to mention the fact that an even worse situation exists with the South African variety. So far, indications are that the UK variety is not much more lethal than the ordinary coronavirus. But this new South African strain is causing a lot of concern. You see, the coronavirus looks like the corona. It has spikes coming out. These are called spike proteins. And the spike proteins are like keys. Keys that then attach to the locks on your cells and your lungs, unlock the cell, opening up the cell for an infection. It turns out that the South African variety has lots more mutations in the protein spike. That is very dangerous because the vaccines that we have today, what do? They prevent the spike proteins from engaging the locks on your cell. So in some sense, the virus is locked out because of the vaccine. But if these locked proteins of the new South African variety have much more mutations in that lock, then perhaps one of these mutations may allow it to get around the extra roadblock set up by the vaccine. So that's causing a lot of concern. If it turns out that this new variety is immune to the vaccine, it means that just like the flu virus, we have to make a booster shot. We have to get vaccinated every year forever, just like with the flu. Well, this is still being investigated. We still don't know whether or not these mutations will render it invulnerable to the vaccine, but a lot of scientists are crossing their fingers right now, hoping that this new virus is not able to evade the new vaccine. And also some good news amidst all this bad news. The good news is, believe it or not, new cases of infections are dropping. Some people say we're now beginning to go over the hump. We're now over the hump. Death rates are also beginning to fall. And the question is, why? Are we doing something unexpected? Well, some demographers simply say that we are suffering from the Christmas season spike due to the fact that social distancing, wearing masks, all of it went out the window during the Christmas season. Well, that winter season is drawing to a close, and people are beginning to listen now. Their family members are coming down with the virus, and they're beginning to now take to heart some of the mandates coming from the governments, both local and federal. And so people are saying that people are more cautious now, plus the fact that people are getting vaccinated. It's slow, it's tedious, and we've run out. Many states this week have officially run out of the coronavirus vaccine. Tens of thousands of individuals lined up for hours waiting to get their appointment to get a shot, only to be told that there's no more vaccines left. Well, the governments of different states around the country hope that by next week a new shipment will come in, but it's not clear if it'll be enough to stop this tremendous logjam. Also, a little bit of good news, Johnson & Johnson is coming out with yet another type of vaccine, which does not have to undergo such rigorous refrigeration protocols, and which does not have to have a booster shot. And so that's coming. And so some people think that that could also be a game changer. It is a vaccine more like the ordinary flu vaccine. In fact, these new varieties, you have to boost them, plus you have to refrigerate them, because they're based on a different principle, based on what is called RNA rather than DNA technology. This new Johnson & Johnson vaccine uses the tried and true method. It takes the coronavirus, kills it or weakens it, and then creates antibodies to the weakened or dead virus, just like we do with polio, just like we do with the flu. And so this does not use more advanced biotechnology to create the vaccine, but seems to work. And so many people are anticipating the Johnson & Johnson vaccine when it starts to come online. And then previously on Exploration, we talked about Finland, where the Helsinki airport is experimenting with dogs that can sniff out the virus. Already, dogs have shown a tremendous ability to sniff out molecules coming from cancer, for example. Well, why not the coronavirus? Yes, it turns out the dogs can be trained to recognize the coronavirus. These dogs trained in Finland can recognize someone with the virus in 10 seconds. Let me repeat that again. In 10 seconds, these dogs can recognize the coronavirus with an accuracy, they say, of 95%. Already, United Arab Emirates, Chile, Finland, and now Miami are experimenting with these dogs. Now, what are the ups and downs of using dogs? First of all, we have to realize that these dogs take a lot of time to train. You simply cannot give them something to sniff and immediately they can recognize where the virus is spreading. No, they have to be specially trained. Second of all, scientists are saying that we haven't really analyzed this 95% effectiveness. At least that's what the internet says these dogs are effective for. But that has to be verified by independent laboratories. But the advantage here is that one day we'll be able to train a machine or a sensor or an artificially intelligent robotic system to recognize the virus as well. So in other words, we have learning machines that can learn to recognize the virus. Right now, dogs can do it better than any machine, but if we do have that system that can recognize the virus using artificial intelligence, then that could really be a game changer. Think of that, 10 seconds with 95% accuracy. Well, let's now move from inner space to outer space for a few minutes. And speaking about outer space, if you saw the movie Star Wars, there's that famous scene where Luke Skywalker looks up into the heavens and sees a double star system. Wouldn't it be great to see not one sun, but two suns in the sky? Well, many astronomers scoffed at that and snickered and said, ha, just goes to show you the Hollywood producers don't know anything about astronomy. Well, who has egg on their face now? The test satellite, currently in outer space, has identified a star system consisting of six stars rotating around each other. Let me repeat that, a six-star system. How is that possible? Well, first of all, we have to realize that a double star system is rather common. Two stars chasing each other like a dog chasing its tail. In fact, about 60% of all the stars you see at night are actually part of double star systems. Usually the companion star is so dim that you cannot see it with the naked eye, but with a telescope, you can see that about 60% of all stars are double stars. Now, to have a triple star system, you have to have, first of all, two stars chasing each other in a plane, and the third star rotating at a much larger distance around the first two stars. That is a stable configuration of a three-star system. However, a six-star system, even though other six-star systems have been found, this is really unusual. How did it form? Well, one theory is that originally it was a three-star system. That is, two stars chasing each other with a third star rotating around the first two stars. But then, the theory goes, each of these stars in turn captured smaller stars And so instead of having just three stars, we had six stars going around each other. Now, what did we learn from this? Well, when I was a kid, I still remember getting my first astronomy book when I was in elementary school. And in the astronomy book, it pretty much said that our solar system is probably average. Our sun is probably an average star. Probably all the other solar systems in the universe are very typical, looking very typically like our system. Well, boy, were we wrong. We know that our solar system is the oddball. So far, we've seen almost none of the 4,000 star systems that we've analyzed. None of them look just like our solar system. Our solar system has planets going in near circular orbits with rocky planets toward the center, gas giants toward the outside, and comets beyond that. Well, it turns out that the average solar system out there doesn't look anything like that. Many of them have gigantic Jupiter-sized planets in highly elliptical orbits, so elliptical that any small planet would have been flung into outer space like a slingshot. Plus the fact that these Jupiter-sized planets orbit very close to the mother star, about the distance of our sun to the planet Mercury, for example. And so our solar system, with near circular orbits, with rocky planets toward the center, gas giants toward the outside, and then comets beyond that, we are the oddball. And so this star system only shows you that if it can obey the laws of physics, if you can imagine it, and it obeys the laws of physics, it probably exists someplace in the universe. I mean, our galaxy, for example, has 100 billion stars in it. And how many galaxies are there? 100 billion galaxies can be seen by the Hubble Space Telescope. So how many stars are there in the known universe? The answer is 100 billion times 100 billion. So in that huge catalog of stars and planets, we find all sorts of oddball configurations, far beyond the imagination of any science fiction writer. And we, as I said before, we are the oddballs. If you can imagine it, and it obeys the laws of physics, then it probably exists somewhere. And science fiction writers have been simply too conservative talking about aliens in outer space from solar systems that look just like our solar system. Well, also speaking about the Earth, we have to worry about the fact that 2020 has now gone down in history as the hottest year ever recorded in the history of science, tying 2016, which had the previous record. In fact, when you look at a seven-year average, the past 7 years, on average, was the hottest seven-year period in the history of science, even with the pandemic. Well, one implication of this has to do with the state of California. Now, I grew up in California. That's where I was born. That's where I was raised. And forest fires, yeah. Prairie fires, forest fires, that was a fact of life. But now we see monstrous forest fires raging through California. And why? Well, there's not just one reason. There's several contributing factors. One of the dominant reasons is global warming, which makes it much more difficult to contain forest fires. The air is drier, hotter, plus the fact there's gross mismanagement of the forests and prairies of California. Brush, debris, for example, is allowed to accumulate on the ground, tinder. And tinder, of course, makes forest fires much more dangerous. And so that has to be looked at, mismanagement, allowing brush and debris to accumulate, and also preventing the natural cycle of forest fires. Forest fires, believe it or not, are part of the cycle of nature. And when we interfere too much with nature's cycles, it comes back to bite us. So not just for one reason, but for several reasons, California was engulfed with the massive forest fires of the past few years. So this is bad news. Even with the coronavirus, even with the fact that the world economy was pretty much shut down for several months in 2020, even with that, 2020 still came out as the hottest year ever recorded in the history of science, tying the year 2016. Also, let me say a few things about flying saucers. As we reported on Exploration last week, the CIA is apparently declassifying most of its entire UFO file, and it's going to be released to the public. Well, in the 1980s, 2,700 pages of UFO sightings and files were released by the government, but the entire stockpile, we think, is at least 2.2 million pages. So the CIA is simply saying it sees no danger to the national security by releasing these documents, so why not? And so if you want to get access to some of these documents, then simply Google it, and you too may have millions of documents coming at you. Now, as we mentioned before on Exploration, 95% of these UFO sightings can be rather easily dismissed as being natural or man-made. First of all, we have radar echoes, weather balloons, meteor showers, atmospheric anomalies, the stealth bomber, all of which can trigger sightings of, quote, UFOs. However, the remaining 5%, well, that's where science begins to end and speculation starts to come in. And as I mentioned before, the hardest sightings to dismiss are those sightings that are done by multiple modes, by multiple individuals. In other words, if one person says that he saw a flying saucer whizzing across the night sky, well, maybe not. Maybe he did see something, or maybe he was drunk or just a thrill seeker and wants to make the evening news. Who knows? But there are sightings, in fact, volumes of sightings, which are very hard to dismiss because they were made by seasoned pilots, seasoned civilians with information about these things, and not just one, but several individuals using several different modes. And again, one of the most famous UFO sightings is the famous JAL incident, Japan Airlines, where an object was seen flying next to a JAL flight. It was seen by the pilots. It was seen by radar. It was seen by people on the ground and in the airplane. And so multiple sightings by multiple modes are the hardest to dismiss. And then the question is, well, what are they? After checking off this whole list of natural phenomena and man-made declassified technologies, we're left with two possibilities. One is that they are experimental Air Force designs that are being tested by the superpowers. And the second is, well, maybe they really are from another planet. Now, some of these new sightings done by the United States Navy pilots have been clocked. They were analyzed by scientists at the University of Albany in New York State. And these physicists used Newton's laws of motion to calculate the parameters of these sightings, which can now be quantified using computers. And they find that the g-forces as these objects zigzag in the trajectory would be sufficient to crush any known living organism. So in other words, they are probably robotic. And second of all, the acceleration is incredible. These objects can go from Mach 5, 5 times the speed of sound, to Mach 20, 20 times the speed of sound, within a matter of seconds to minutes. That's an enormous acceleration. And then the question is, what are they? Well, after you cross out the stealth bomber, as you cross out many of the known technologies, there's only one thing left, and that is hypersonic drones. Hypersonic drones, in fact, can go from Mach 5 to Mach 20, and they can zigzag, just like these UFOs. And so that's a possibility. Now, Vladimir Putin admitted that, yes, it has tested and now makes operational their version of the hypersonic drone. The Chinese, not to be outdone, admitted that they are working on hypersonic drones. And Boeing admitted that, yes, it too was looking into hypersonic drones, but was canceled. The U.S. program was canceled about 2 years ago because of crashes. You see, when these drones zigzag upon reentry into the atmosphere, they become unstable. But that's the whole point. You want them to zigzag to evade a Star Wars missile shield. That's the whole point. But by zigzagging, you become unstable, and you can easily spiral out of control. And that's what happened to the U.S. hypersonic drone. Well, because of the announcement by Vladimir Putin, Pentagon officials said that, well, we can't allow a hypersonic drone gap to emerge. And so they're going to refund. They're going to start to refund hypersonic drones. So are these UFO sightings, hypersonic drones being picked up by the United States Navy and Air Force? We don't know. But some scientists who have looked at these radar sightings noticed a few things that are rather unusual. First of all, the recent UFO sightings do not take place over the continental United States. They take place over the perimeter of the United States. So, in other words, they seem to respect national boundaries. Now, why is that important? Because, you see, if you are a Chinese or a Russian technocrat fielding some of these hypersonic drones, you don't want to provoke a nuclear war. You don't want to create a conflict. No, you want to basically test the other side's aircraft ability and technology by skimming their national boundaries, because you do not want to create an incident whereby your craft is then shot down and picked up and identified as being from China or Russia. That could cause an international conflict. And so some people are pointing out that all the recent sightings take place off the coast of the United States, respecting national boundaries, meaning that they could be Chinese or they could be Russian. Well, your guess is as good as mine. However, as I mentioned before, the CIA is now declassifying millions of pages of this material, and you want to go through it yourself, perhaps, and make up your own mind. That's it for the first part of Exploration. Stay tuned for the second half when we bring on world-renowned environmentalist Lester Brown on the airwaves. And if you want to know more about my work, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org, and find out about the 4 New York Times bestsellers that I've written, and also the fact that I have essentially millions of fans on Facebook. So, once again, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. So stay tuned for the second half of Exploration. Welcome back to Exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku. In the second half of Exploration, we're going to continue our discussion about global warming, the fact that 2020 went down as the hottest year ever recorded in the history of science, tying 2016. And we're going to bring on our special guest today in a pre-recorded interview, Lester Brown. If you were to name a handful of the world's leading environmentalists, Lester Brown would be on that list. He's the founder of the World Watch Institute, which is the clearinghouse for environmental news and information, and also a founding member of the Earth Policy Institute. And we're going to talk about the state of the planet. Even with the coronavirus, temperatures still start to rise. Even with the reduction of carbon dioxide, so much activity has taken place industrially that the momentum has made 2020 the hottest year ever recorded in the history of science, tying 2016. So once again, our special guest today is environmentalist Lester Brown, founder of the World Watch Institute.
Mr. Brown, you're one of the world's most prominent, distinguished environmentalists. But when you were a youth, when you were a child, what was it that set you off on this long journey to save the environment?
Well, though I grew up on a small farm in southern New Jersey, probably some of the things I was reading early on had an influence. I remember I was about 10 years old reading Swiss Family Robinson, for example, which is probably the book that has had more influence than any other. And then later on in high school, reading some of Richard Halliburton's books, The Book of Marvels and things. And he's a forgotten author now, but for my generation, he was very interesting. And then beyond that, after I graduated from Rutgers with an agricultural science degree, I had a chance to spend half a year living in Indian villages under the International Farm Youth Exchange Program. And so that experience and the exposure to population pressure and food issues in India at that time, I think had a long-term effect on my thinking and my career.
Okay, well, now let's talk about something that's rarely talked about, and that is social collapse. What happens when we face a, quote, perfect storm of food shortages and water scarcity and costly oil? John Bennington of the United Kingdom, chief science advisor, talked about a perfect storm by 2030. And then Jonathan Porritt, former chair of the UK Sustainable Development Commission, talked about, well, maybe it could be as close as 2020. So what are your thoughts about something that's very rarely talked about, and that is complete total collapse? When might it happen? What could trigger it?
Well, if I were to pick what I think is the weak link in our global civilization, it would be the food supply. And it took me some time to reach that conclusion, because I had assumed for a long time that for our modern advanced technology civilization, food would not be an issue for us. But I now think not only that food is or could be the weak link, I think it is the weak link, and I think we're now beginning to see that. And to just give you a quick extension of John Bennington and Jonathan Porritt's thinking, John Bennington 2030, Jonathan Porritt 2020, I think it could come at any time. And to illustrate that, I would simply go back to the heat wave in Western Russia this past summer, when the average temperature in Moscow for the month of July was 14 degrees Fahrenheit above the norm. I mean, if someone had mentioned that as a possibility, you know, at this time last year, I would have said, you know, I'm not a climate denier, but 14 degrees is really sort of beyond
the
pale. And but that's exactly what happened. Now, it cost the Russians 40% of their grain crop this year. They've been hoping for about 100 million tons. And because of the extreme heat and drought, they ended up with about 60 million tons. But the world was lucky in the sense that if that heat wave had been centered not in Moscow, but in Chicago, and if the United States had lost 40% of its 400 million ton grain harvest, we, the U.S. and the world, would have lost 160 million tons of grain. World grain stocks would then have dropped to the lowest level in history, the lowest level on record. And grain prices would have gone far beyond anything we've seen, even those in the last few years. Food prices would have begun climbing around the world. Grain exporting countries would have begun to restrict exports to try to keep their food prices at a manageable level. And then we probably would have seen oil exporting countries begin to try to barter oil for grain in order to ensure that they needed. Scores of importing countries, many of them lower income ones, would have been scrambling for whatever was left. and we would have seen food riots and demonstrations on a scale we've not seen before, because desperate people do desperate things. We would have seen left instead of smoke in Moscow from respiratory and heat stresses. We would have been watching on the news reports of falling governments in one country after another. And moving eastward in the northern hemisphere and across the temperate zone countries has actually, at some points in the last few weeks, has broken up entirely. And some parts of it are flowing north, some are flowing south, and it is doing two things. It is pulling cold air down in parts. It has snowstorms in Arkansas and Texas and Georgia, and at the same time, northern Canada, much which in the would raise sea level 23 feet or 7 meters. But even a 3-foot rise in sea level, and incidentally, the more recent projections show sea level rising by up to 6 feet during this century, but even a 3-foot rise in sea level would inundate half the rice land in Bangladesh. The World Bank has a very good map showing that. A 3-foot rise in sea level would inundate a good part of the Mekong Delta, which produces half the rice in Vietnam, which is the world's number two rice exporter. And there are, I think, another 19 or so rice-growing river deltas in Asia, which would be affected by just a 3-foot rise in sea level. Now, what's so interesting about this, Michio, is that the idea that ice melting on a large island in the far North Atlantic can shrink the rice harvest in Asia, where half the world's people live, is not obviously intuitive. I mean, when you think about it, you know, it becomes very clear. But most people don't have the time and luxury to think about all these interrelationships and what they translate into. The other form of ice melting, of course, is mountain glaciers. And this is also of overwhelming importance in Asia, because it is the ice melt from the glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau that sustains the flow of the major rivers in Asia during the dry season. This includes the Indus, the Ganges, the Mekong, the Yangtze, the Yellow River, and so forth. And so this ice melt during the dry season sustains not only the flow of those rivers, but the irrigation systems dependent on those rivers. So we're looking here at a potentially huge disruption in both rice and wheat production in countries like India and China. One of the examples I use for China is that if, for this and other reasons, China comes into the world market for large quantities of grain, as it is probably about to do, it will come to the United States because we are far and away the world's largest grain exporter. For American consumers, this is a nightmare scenario, because what we're looking at is American consumers competing with 1.4 billion Chinese consumers with rapidly rising incomes for our grain harvest, thus driving up our food prices. Now, historically, when faced with a situation like this, as we were in the mid-70s, we restricted exports. We actually banned exports of soybeans to Japan because our soybean prices were rising so fast. The problem today is that China is our banker, and therefore, it's going to be very difficult for us to say to the Chinese, you know, get lost, or you know, we're going to restrict the amount of grain you can import. Every month, when the Treasury Department holds its auctions of securities, of Treasury securities to cover our fiscal deficit, China's been one of the biggest buyers there. They now hold $900 billion of U.S. Treasury securities. So, like it or not, you and I and 310 million other Americans are going to be sharing our grain harvest with the Chinese within the next few years.
Okay, now let's talk about the consequences. We talked about the foundational structural problems that could set off the nightmare of a social collapse. And now let's talk about the consequences of all this. First of all, environmental refugees. We're accustomed to seeing pictures of refugees fleeing wars and famines. Here you're talking about environmental refugees. Could you elaborate?
Environmental refugees include include refugees that are caused or displaced by a number of environmental trends. One is simply expanding deserts. I mentioned the 23,000 villages in northwestern China that have either been totally abandoned or partly abandoned because the farmers are losing their cropland to the sand dunes. That's one thing. Another thing is the loss of water supply. When aquifers are depleted in some areas, then people are forced to move elsewhere to wherever they can find water. So we have expanding deserts, we have falling water tables, and we have ice melting, all contributing to refugees. To a flow of environmental refugees in the future that could number in the hundreds of millions. I mean, we could see people being forced to move around the planet, many of them across national boundaries, on a scale that we've not even imagined before. For example, rising sea level. Many of the world's largest cities are basically coastal cities, not that far above sea level. Shanghai. New York, London, Cairo, Washington, D.C., Miami. I mean, there are scores of countries that are just very close to sea level. And what that would translate into in a country like the United States, if we had a rise in sea level, just even a few feet, we would see the emergence of two real estate markets. One would be the coastal real estate market. That would include a good part of Florida, parts of the East Coast, southern New Jersey, New York City, the Cape Cod area of Massachusetts, for example. We would see real estate prices in these markets falling. At the same time, we'd see real estate prices in the rest of the country rising as people retreated from rising seas and had to look for new housing elsewhere. And again, it's not something we normally think about, but it's something that could be affecting real estate markets, in the not too distant future, as it becomes clear that sea level is rising and is going to be rising at an accelerating rate. I mean, it's interesting now that various planning bodies, in places like California, New York, in the state of Florida, southern Louisiana, the Netherlands, in Europe, the UK, the planning bodies here who are working on things in coastal regions are actually making certain assumptions about what they think sea level rise will be and integrating those into their planning, whether it's residential, industrial development, or transport systems, or whatever. We're looking at a world with stresses that we've never had to face since civilization first emerged 6,000 years ago.
And do you foresee a time when we're going to have dikes around Manhattan and levees and different kinds of mechanical devices to save our cities from going underwater?
Well, we either have to think of doing that, which can be very costly. I think in the Netherlands, the efforts to maintain their dikes and everything, and they have a very sophisticated, complex system. I think the budget for that is comparable to their defense budget. I mean, it is a defense budget in a sense, but it's a very substantial expenditure. And while New York might be able to afford to build some of those dikes around the city, there are many places in the world that cannot afford to do that. I think of Bangladesh. And one reason that India has built a wall between India and Bangladesh is to anticipate and prevent that potential movement in one of the countries that's among the most vulnerable to rising sea level.
Now, the Global Business Network, an organization that we interviewed on exploration, was commissioned by the Pentagon several years ago to look at a worst-case scenario when nuclear weapons might be used to prevent environmental refugees from overwhelming borders. And that report singled out the border between Bangladesh and its neighboring countries when hundreds of millions of people could be pouring over the border, and nations overwhelmed by this may use nuclear weapons. That's pretty drastic, right?
It is. What is difficult for us now to sort of evaluate is how desperate people and desperate governments will behave when stresses begin to reach an unmanageable level. We don't know because we haven't been here before. We've not had environmental trends before like expanding deserts and falling water tables and rising sea level to drive the flow of refugees on the scale that we're now looking at.
Okay. Also, in your book, you talk about failing states. These are things that we never really talked about a generation ago during the Cold War. But now more and more we're encountering failed states. And is the situation going to get worse?
Well, as I point out in World on the Edge, perhaps the most basic indicator that will tell us more about our future than any other is what happens to the number of failing states. And if we look back over the last 5 or 6 years now, we see that each year the number of failing states is increasing. And it raises a disturbing question, which is, how many failing states before we have a failing global civilization? And the answer is, we don't know. We haven't been here before. Even the concept of failing states has entered our vocabulary only, a decade or so ago. It's a new idea because throughout most of my working career, beginning back in the 50s, we were looking at a world where we were building new nation states. The whole decolonization period was characterized by a great increase in the number of states, and then more recently, the breakup of the Soviet Union created a number of independent states. So this is a difficult thing for us to deal with. I mean, if you were to just sort of step back and sort of think about the failure of a global civilization, the first thing you would look for would be the failure of individual nation states. And when they begin to fail, they create all sorts of problems for the world. I mean, Haiti has become an ecological basket case, now heavily dependent on the World Food Program, Lifeline, and aid programs to sustain it as a country. Even the UN peacekeeping force there has taken the place or helps the local police to maintain stability and at least some degree of personal security. Then we have a country like Pakistan, which is the most populous failing state, but it's also a failing state with nuclear weapons, and that becomes a very high risk situation. Then we have countries like Somalia. Well, I shouldn't say countries. Somalia is a place on the map, but it's not a country in any meaningful sense of the word. with people trying to make a living by piracy and creating headaches for many countries around the world who either depend on imported oil coming out of the Persian Gulf through the Indian Ocean or through the Suez Canal. Much of the world's traffic goes through that that region where the Somali pirates operate. And the amazing thing is there are 17 countries now with naval units in that region to deal with the problem of piracy. But it keeps getting worse and worse. I mean, I was reading an article in The Economist a year ago, and it was summing up 2009 and the earnings of the pirates and so forth. It was almost like a corporate business report, you know, pointing out how many ships they'd taken, what the average return per ship was, and what the total earnings were and that sort of thing. And it's the kind of problem that's very difficult to deal with. And so we're not dealing with it effectively. We're trying, but we haven't had much success.
And when we have a failing state, we also have a failing economy, right?
No question. And in the case of Somalia or Haiti, you have a lot of hungry people. You have countries that are dependent on the UN World Food Program for the food lifeline. I mean, it really does help sustain them. They can't feed themselves. And we're seeing there's some 35 countries now that are getting food aid from the UN World Food Program. Roughly half of those countries are on a more or less permanent food lifeline.
And I guess the world didn't really pay attention to these failed states until they became hotbeds of piracy and terrorism, right?
Yeah, piracy, terrorism, and drugs. Afghanistan is now the world's, you know, totally dominates the world heroin market, for example. So we have some real challenges now in dealing with this. I mentioned that the number of failing states is a key indicator. The three indicators that I look at are, you know, to give us a sense of where the world is headed and what our future will be like. The first one is grain prices. That's an economic indicator. And as the price of grain goes up, things get more and more dicey in the world. The second indicator is the number of hungry people in the world. That number was declining during the closing decades of the last century, but then at the turn of the century, it turned up, and it had gotten down to about 825 million. It's now up around a billion, and looks like it's going to continue climbing. And the third indicator is a political indicator, which is the number of failing states in the world. So it's grain prices, the number of hungry people, and failing states that I think are three of the key indicators that will tell us where we're headed in the future.
Well, that concludes our interview with Lester Brown, noted environmentalist, founder of the World Wash Institute and the Earth Policy Institute. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku. Go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org, to find out what I'm up to. And let me just make this announcement that starting in April, I'll be on a book tour. That's right, an online book tour. And I'll be promoting my latest new book. It's called The God Equation, The Quest for a Theory of Everything. We're going to talk about the quest started by Einstein to unify all the laws of nature into one equation so that we could, quote, read the mind of God. And it traces the history going all the way back to Isaac Newton and ending up on string theory, which is what I do for a living. And we're going to talk about the controversies that this theory has undergone over the decades. Realize that even today, Nobel Prize winners are taking opposite points of view concerning whether or not we will have a theory of everything. An equation, perhaps no more than 1 inch long, that would give us all the foundations, all the understanding of the universe itself. Think of the equation E equals mc squared, for example. That equation is only half an inch long, but that unlocked the secret of the stars, unlocked the engine that drives the entire universe. But we want an even more powerful equation, perhaps also 1 inch long, that would unify electromagnetism, that is light, electricity, and magnetism, with the nuclear force, the strong and the weak nuclear force, with gravitation as well. Truly a theory of all creations. And that's why it's called the God equation. In the beginning, this equation set off the Big Bang and set off the universe as we know it. Now, the book also traces the early origin of the ancients, who also decided that they too wanted a theory of everything. The Greeks, for example, 2,000 years ago, had two ideas for a theory of everything. One was the theory of atoms. Democritus was the philosopher who said that everything is composed of tiny little steel balls called atoms. But then there was also Pythagoras. Over 2,000 years ago, not only did he discover the Pythagorean theorem, which describes right triangles, he also said that music is the paradigm that unifies the universe. And he worked out the mathematics of music. He reduced all of resonances into mathematics, showing that certain notes like A, B flat, C sharp, are in certain ratios, and that these ratios gave us the music of the spheres. Well, unfortunately, after the Roman Empire fell, all these early ideas were pretty much forgotten until now. Now the theory of atoms has become, of course, atomic physics and nuclear physics. And the Pythagorean idea about music, well, that's become string theory. In string theory, all the subatomic particles we see in nature are nothing but notes, vibrating notes on a tiny musical string. So that, what is physics? Physics is the laws of harmonies of these vibrating strings. What is chemistry? Chemistry is the melodies you can play on these vibrating strings. What is the universe? The universe is a symphony of strings. And then what is the mind of God? The mind of God would be cosmic music resonating through hyperspace. That would be the mind of God. So go to my website, mkaku.org, and as I said before, I'll be on an online national book tour talking about my latest book, coming out in April, by the way. My latest book, The God Equation, The Quest for the Theory of Everything.